Hello, this is William Fink, and this is Chris Agenia Internet Radio. Today is Friday, February 14th, 2025. I can't even get the date right. This evening, I'm going to present part 22 of my commentary on Isaiah, and this is titled The Justice in Judgment. With our last presentation here, the burden of Tyre, concluding Isaiah chapter 23, the prophet seems to have finally come to the end of his long list of burdens concerning certain of the people of the ancient world of Israel. So, as we hope to have explained, the burdens of Tyre, Babylon, Moab, Egypt, the desert of the sea, Duma, which is much more likely should have been Edom, the burden of Arabia, and the burden of Jerusalem in the Valley of Vision, and finally the burden of Tyre, had all actually been directed at Israelites who had been in the process of being taken into captivity, or in the process of trying to avoid captivity, the reason for the burdens of Egypt and Arabia. So even where statements are made concerning Babylonians, Egyptians, or Arabs, they were made for the sake of the children of Israel and not for the sake of those others. The entire Bible was written for the sake of the children of Israel. And the others are of no consequence unless Yahweh uses them to punish Israel. So each of the burdens were ominous warnings for Israel. But Israel was also granted some degree of hope or mercy throughout. As we closed Isaiah chapter 23, concerning the Tyrians, the promise of mercy was quite subtle, where, speaking of the merchandise of ancient Tyre, the word of Yahweh declared that it would be for them that dwell before Yahweh to eat sufficiently and for durable clothing. This message of hope for the Israelites of Tyre, those are the Tyrians who dwell before Yahweh, evokes the words of Christ in Luke chapter 12, where he told his disciples, in part, "Consider the lilies, how they grow. They toil not, they spin not," meaning they don't spin yarn. "And yet I say unto you, that Solomon, in all his glory, was not arrayed like one of these. If then God so clothes the grass, which is today in the field, and tomorrow is cast into the oven, how much more will he clothe you, O ye of little faith? And seek not what ye shall eat, or what ye shall drink, neither be ye of doubtful mind. Having food and raiment is enough of a blessing, and it is probably better than one may expect in a time of judgment." The word for durable there is athik, and Strong's defined it as probably antique, that is, venerable or splendid. So it is evident that Yahweh would even clothe them well. Likewise, he would also feed them well, as the word for sufficiently is soba, which is defined as satiety, so that they would be satisfied with their victuals. However, we are not finished discussing Tyre, or really any of these burdens, as the prophet now begins lamenting the judgment of Yahweh. And having the advantage of hindsight, we can know how this judgment was executed. So we should consider the justice in that judgment, as we may see the world around us today, and the degree to which Christians have once again accepted transgression of the law, and realize that we also may be liable to that same judgment. As a society, we are liable to it. As individuals, we may be liable to it. The books of the prophets were not preserved as mere curiosities, but, as Paul of Tarsus had explained in Romans chapter 15, for whatsoever things were written aforetime were written for our learning, that we through patience and comfort of the scriptures might have hope. Otherwise, we may look at the world around us as we can see that it is indeed being judged, and we would have no hope. So as we proceed with Isaiah chapter 24, we are not quite finished with Tyre, as the context has not changed from the previous chapter. And the prophet is actually lamenting what would become of Tyre and all of Israel, including Jerusalem. So some of the language employed here had later been evoked in the words of Jeremiah and Ezekiel in reference to both Tyre and Jerusalem. The statements made here in the context of the burden of Tyre further demonstrate that the Tyrians were of Israel. And with that, we shall proceed with Isaiah chapter 24. Behold, Yahweh makes the earth empty and makes it waste, and turns it upside down, and scatters abroad the inhabitants thereof. There are many references to the earth here, as the King James Version has often translated a word that means land, and not the entire planet. The word translated as earth, eretz, would better have been rendered as land, since here it refers specifically to the land of Israel. Although it is also evident in Strong's Concordance, according to a certain Bible software program, that this word translated as land, this word was translated as land approximately 1,543 times, and as earth 712 times, as country 140 times, as ground 98 times, and a handful of times it was translated in various other ways in the King James Version of the Bible. It rarely refers, very rarely, refers to the entire planet, or can be interpreted in that fashion, justly. Here where Yahweh is said to make the earth empty and turn it upside down, these are allegories for the degree of destruction which the particular land or country shall suffer, which should not necessarily be taken literally by the reader, although they should be translated literally in order to maintain the sense of the original allegories or idioms. Here the word panim, in its feminine form, panaya, which literally means face, is used with the verb avath, which is defined by Strong's as rest, or as in Brown Driver Briggs, in its active form, to bend or make crooked. So the phrase does not necessarily mean turn upside down, but rather it is an idiomatic expression reflecting the degree of disorder which shall come upon the land on account of its coming judgment. And here I feel it is necessary to elaborate on this, because there are certain heretics who insist such passages must be accepted literally as they appear in particular translations. So there are people who await some spectacular geological or astronomical event, and that is a permanent distraction which keeps them from considering the actual judgment which is taking place all around them. And more importantly, why the world suffers the disorders and upheavals which are evident even in recent history. Many people today would rather argue about the shape of the earth than to consider the consequences of sin and the justice in judgment. A flat earth is not going to save anyone, but rather, repentance and a return to the commandments of Yahweh our God is the only route to salvation. And even then, we have to await his coming. Thus far here in Isaiah, the prophet has already condemned Jerusalem as early as the very start of his ministry. For example, where in chapter 3 he wrote that Jerusalem is ruined and Judah is fallen. And again in the parable of the vineyard in Isaiah chapter 5. Now here, in Isaiah chapter 24, it is probably at least 20 years later, and Jerusalem has not yet been destroyed, at least in the eyes of men. And I'm sorry because I'm laughing because somebody in the chat talked about flipping a pancake. And I shouldn't let that be a distraction, but sometimes it just is. So the judgment forewarned, in the words of the prophets, is an ongoing process, and generations of men may not see it until after it has happened, although they may suffer its consequences as it is happening. The men of the time of Hezekiah had never experienced the glory of Jerusalem as it was in the time of David and Solomon. So they would not even have realized how far it had already fallen. This prolonged process of punishment for sin is also an element of the justice in judgment, that many generations may experience the consequences of sin and the inevitable decay. Today we have little excuse, since we have films and photographs of a world that was not yet overrun with beasts. So in the time of Jeremiah, perhaps 100 or so years later, both he and Ezekiel, as well as the other prophets, had continued foreboding the destruction of Jerusalem, which by that time had evidently sunk much further into the depths of depravity, and in spite of the attempted reforms of Josiah. In the opening chapters of Jeremiah, the prophet had announced the punishment which would fall upon Jerusalem for the people of his own time. To put this in perspective, Isaiah is writing here probably about 715 BC. The reforms of Josiah began around 640 BC, and Jeremiah had probably written this fourth chapter from his prophecy. I will actually cite parts of chapter 2 somewhere else, I believe. Jeremiah wrote this fourth chapter of his prophecy sometime around 620 or so BC. In the opening chapters of Jeremiah the prophet, he had announced the punishment which would fall upon Jerusalem for the people of his own time. And then in chapter 4, we read in part, "Destruction upon destruction is cried, for the whole land is spoiled. Suddenly are my tents spoiled, and my curtains in a moment. How long shall I see the standard and hear the sound of the trumpet? For my people is foolish. They have not known me. They are sottish children, and they have no understanding. They are wise to do evil, but to do good they have no knowledge. I beheld the earth, and lo, it was without form and void, and the heavens, and they had no light. I beheld the mountains, and lo, they trembled, and all the hills moved lightly. I beheld, and lo, there was no man. And all the birds of heaven were fled. I beheld, and lo, the fruitful place was a wilderness, and all the cities thereof were broken down at the presence of Yahweh and by his fierce anger. While some of the language is similar to what we see here, and in subsequent verses of Isaiah, Jeremiah had even borrowed phrases from Genesis chapter 1, using certain concepts from the creation account as a rhetorical device. But now, before Isaiah continues to describe the land, or perhaps country would be an even better way to translate the word in this context, he speaks in reference to the people. Verse 2, Isaiah chapter 24. And it shall be, as with the people, so with the priest. As with the servant, so with his master. As with the maid, so with her mistress. As with the buyer, so with the seller. As with the lender, so with the borrower. As with the taker of usury, because lending and usury are not the same thing, so with the giver of usury to him. This is not an indictment of any particular sin, since the only sin specified here is usury. And there were evidently far worse sins, as we shall see. There were far worse sins than usury in ancient Israel. Here we are only informed that all of the people would suffer equally in this judgment, regardless of their status or stature in the community. That is the meaning of the phrase respective persons, as it had first been described in Deuteronomy chapter 1, in words attributed to Moses. And I charged your judges at that time, saying, hear the causes between your brethren, and judge righteously between every man and his brother, and the stranger that is with him. Ye shall not respect persons in judgment, but ye shall hear the small as well as the great. Ye shall not be afraid of the face of man, his appearance. For the judgment is God's. And then this is Moses instructing the people. So he tells them, and the cause that is too hard for you, bring it to me, and I will hear it. So it is for with Yahweh that judging the people here, he would judge them as equally as he had demanded in his own law, which is also an aspect of the justice in judgment, the justice in the judgment of God. But there was another aspect of the terminology which Isaiah had used here, where he sets a priest in juxtaposition to the people, and a servant to a master, and a maid to a mistress, and a buyer to a seller. And that is descriptive of the ordering of people, which we call society. Likewise, the references to the fate of the earth here are actually descriptive of the fate of the society upon the land, which in our modern English is somewhat reflected in the manner in which we use the term country. In this context, one of the possible uses of the term country is defined in the Oxford Languages Dictionary as a nation with its own government occupying a particular territory, which we may consider the society of a nation or people, since a society is defined in that same dictionary as the ordering of the people in a community. In Deuteronomy chapter 16, we read, "Judges and officers shalt thou make thee in all thy gates, which Yahweh thy God gives thee, throughout thy tribes, and they shall judge the people with just judgment. Thou shalt not wrest judgment, force it or wrestle with it in a manner to pervert it," which that word wrest in Hebrew also means. "Thou shalt not respect persons, neither take a gift, for a gift does blind the eyes of the wise and pervert the words of the righteous. That which is altogether just shalt thou follow, that thou mayest live and inherit the land which Yahweh thy God gives thee." However, the people failed to judge equitably. They failed to obey this commandment. And we read in Isaiah chapter 5, "For the vineyard of Yahweh of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah his pleasant plant. And he looked for judgment, but behold, oppression; for righteousness, but behold, a cry." So once again, where Yahweh had promised to maintain at least some of the people of Tyre, those who dwell before Yahweh, even that is better than an unjust people may have expected in a time of judgment. Now, returning to Isaiah's descriptions of the land, there is language quite similar to the words which we have just seen from Jeremiah chapter 4 concerning Judah. Verse 3, Isaiah chapter 24. "In our writings and translations of the New Testament, we generally render the Greek..." I'm sorry, I didn't read verse 3. "The land shall be utterly emptied and utterly spoiled, for Yahweh has spoken this word. The earth mourns and fades away. The world languishes and fades away. The haughty people of the earth do languish." In our writings and translations of the New Testament, as I was saying, we generally render the Greek word cosmos as society. Even capitalizing it, word describes a particular society. Because the Greek word cosmos generally means order, or of things, it describes their natural order, or the ornament, or decoration, or arrangement of things, as it is defined by Liddell and Scott. This is how we would also frequently interpret the Hebrew word, tebel, which Strong's relates to a verb meaning to flow or bring, which is yabal. And Brown Driver Briggs agrees, but they added a relationship to another similar word, yabal. It's a slightly longer version of yabal, which is a stream as being productive. I can't speak tonight. So Strong's relates Tebel to Yabal, and Brown Driver Briggs agree, and they also relate it to Yabal. And this is the word that's often translated as world. How do we get world out of something productive or a stream the way we believe world to mean the planet? Well, the word simply doesn't mean the planet in most cases. It simply refers to something which is productive. So in their definition of the word, they also state that it is perhaps a poetic synonym of the word eretz, which means land. We would not ever insist that such a word must refer to what we now know as the entire planet, sometimes called the world. So here, and often elsewhere, we would also translate this word for world as society, as being something productive, a productive, the people in their produce and their ability to have things and trade things and give things away and make exchanges with one another, that is why societies are formed. So that people can survive in an orderly fashion, find a business and go about it so that you could acquire things that you need to live and raise your children. Now Isaiah explicitly describes the reason for judgment. The earth also is defiled under the inhabitants thereof, because they have transgressed the laws, changed the ordinance, broken the everlasting covenant. This is spoken in reference to Tyre, as well as the rest of Israel and Judah. They transgressed the laws. They must have been Israelites. The covenants with Abraham were based on promises that are unconditional and everlasting. But the Sinai covenant, while it was described as everlasting, sometimes it's called the Levitical covenant, it was based on conditions as they are described from Exodus chapter 20. That's where the Sinai covenant began to be made. I mean, you could probably wind it back to Exodus chapter 19. It's really immaterial. They start, the conditions start with the 10 basic commandments. And I call them basic commandments because there's many other commandments in the law that we should also keep. Those 10 basic commandments begin in Exodus chapter 20. That's the first of the conditions of the Sinai covenant. So after the conditions of the covenant were given, which are those 10 commandments and many others, we read in Exodus chapter 24, and Moses came and told the people all the words of Yahweh and all the judgments, and all the people answered with one voice and said, this is the conditions, all the words which Yahweh has said, we will do. And Moses wrote all the words of Yahweh and rose up early in the morning and built an altar under the hill and 12 pillars according to the 12 tribes of Israel. And he sent young men of the children of Israel, which offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings of oxen unto Yahweh. And Moses took half of the blood and put it in basins, and half of the blood he sprinkled on the altar. And he took the book of the covenant and read in the audience of the people. And they said, all that Yahweh has said will we do and be obedient. And Moses took the blood and sprinkled it on the people and said, behold the blood of the covenant, which Yahweh has made with you concerning all these words. So in order to assure the Sinai covenant, the people had to agree that all the words which Yahweh has said, we will do, or will we do. When they failed to do all of those words, because they continually transgressed the law, then on their account, the covenant is broken. And here they are in the midst of suffering judgment for the breaking, which is basically the loss of the society that Yahweh had provided to them under the terms of that covenant. There is justice in that judgment because Yahweh God had promised to preserve and provide for them so long as they kept his law. So as Luke had recorded in the words of Zacharias, the father of John the Baptist, in Luke chapter 1, the purpose of Christ was to perform the mercy promised to our fathers and to remember his holy covenant, the oath which he swore to our father Abraham, that he would grant unto us, and I will only read that much, but it's clear that he's not talking about the Sinai covenant. He's talking about the covenant which he made with Abraham that had no restrictions on it. And there was that was a blood covenant also, just like Sinai was a blood covenant. Yahweh had Abraham collect some animals, split them in half, and Yahweh passed through the middle of them, but Abraham did not. So Yahweh shall keep those promises, because it's a one-way, totally unilateral covenant. There is no demand whatsoever placed on Abraham when Yahweh had done that. The only demand, which is the demand of circumcision, came several, probably several years later in Genesis chapter 17. I believe Yahweh passed through the beast in Genesis chapter 15. And Abraham was expected to do nothing. And Yahweh will keep his promises. Okay. Not all of this is in my notes. In the 127th Psalm, we read, "Except Yahweh build the house, they labor in vain that build it. Except Yahweh keep the city, the watchman wakes, but in vain." Abraham was an apparently wealthy man, and he had no house and no city, rather having lived in the open fields in tents. In Genesis chapter 13, we read, "And Abram was very rich in cattle, in silver, and in gold." There were no police to call in those days, no society with just laws which would protect him. Yet he had maintained his wealth, even while sojourning in the wilderness. Having lived blamelessly and having sought to please God, he had suffered little harm outside of the expected trials of life, such as the death of Sarah in her old age, or the necessary separation of Ishmael for the sake of Isaac. The only explanation for this is found in Genesis chapter 15, where we read, "After these things, the word of Yahweh came unto Abram in a vision, saying, Fear not, Abram, I am thy shield and thy exceedingly great reward." Therefore, as long as there is obedience to Yahweh, men should have no fear of evil, unless they are evil men. Yet from the time of Isaiah, the sins of the children of Israel had progressed. Warnings and warnings of judgment became even more graphic than what Isaiah offers here. As we read in Jeremiah chapter 19, "And say, Hear the word of Yahweh, O kings of Judah and inhabitants of Jerusalem. Thus saith Yahweh of hosts, the God of Israel, Behold, I will bring evil upon this place, the which whosoever heareth, his ears shall tingle, because they have forsaken me and have estranged this place, and have burned incense in it unto other gods, whom neither they nor their fathers have known, nor the kings of Judah, and have filled this place with the blood of innocents. They have built also the high places of Baal, to burn their sons with fire for burnt offerings unto Baal, which I commanded not, nor spoke it, neither came it into my mind. Therefore, behold, the days come, saith Yahweh, that this place shall no more be called Tophet, nor the valley of the son of Hinnom, but the valley of slaughter. And I will make void the council of Judah and Jerusalem in this place. And I will cause them to fall by the sword before their enemies, and by the hands of them that seek their lives. And their carcasses will I give to be meat for the fowls of the heaven, and for the beasts of the earth. And I will make this city desolate and a hissing. Everyone that passes thereby shall be astonished and hiss because of all the plagues thereof. And while Jeremiah was indeed more graphic, here Isaiah continues to forewarn of this same judgment. Speaking of Tyre, therefore has the curse devoured the earth, and they that dwell therein are desolate. Therefore the inhabitants of the earth are burned, and few men left, the inhabitants of that land. The earth can't mean the planet here, because I don't think that anybody else, anywhere else in the world, was burned at the same time. This also seems to have been a just judgment, but we may understand the historical circumstances which justify such a horrible punishment. While Isaiah had given his oracles against Jerusalem much earlier, and again here in the burden of the Valley of Vision, and while we cited Jeremiah where he had spoken of Jerusalem, the context of this prophecy here is still in reference to what would become of Tyre. However, there is a connection, because Jerusalem would later suffer the same fate for what are ostensibly the same sins. So according to what we may see in Scripture, it seems that the first king of Judah to do something so horrible as to sacrifice a son to Moloch was Ahaz, the father of Hezekiah, where we read in 2 Kings chapter 15, and this is the same Ahaz whom Isaiah recorded his death earlier in his series of burdens. In the 17th year of Pekah, the son of Remaliah, Ahaz, the son of Jotham, king of Judah, began to reign. 20 years old was Ahaz when he began to reign, and he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem, and did not, that was which was right in the sight of Yahweh his God, like David his father. But he walked in the way of the kings of Israel, yeah, and made his son to pass through the fire, according to the abominations of the heathen, whom Yahweh cast out from before the children of Israel. The prophet Amos had mentioned the worship of Moloch in regard to Israel in Amos chapters 5 and 7. But while he made no explicit references to the sacrifice of children, the passage from 2 Kings certainly informs us that they had been making such sacrifices, at least in Israel, up to the time of Ahaz. In a later passage from 2 Kings chapter 17, we read where the people of Judah engaged in the practice, which seems to have started in Judah with Ahaz, because it is not mentioned in Judah before his time. Yet Yahweh testified against Israel and against Judah by all the prophets and by all the seers, saying, "Turn ye from your evil ways, and keep my commandments and my statutes, according to all the law which I commanded your fathers, and which I sent to you by my servants the prophets. Notwithstanding, they would not hear, but hardened their necks, like to the neck of their fathers, that did not believe in Yahweh their God. And they had rejected his statutes and his covenant that he made with their fathers, and his testimonies which he testified against them. And they followed vanity, and became vain, and went after the heathen that were round about them, concerning whom Yahweh had charged them, that they should not do like them. And they left all the commandments of Yahweh their God, and they made them molten images, even two calves, and made a grove, and worshipped all the hosts of heaven, and served Baal. And they caused their sons and their daughters to pass through the fire, and used divination and enchantments, and sold themselves to do evil in the sight of Yahweh, to provoke him to anger." While the two calves are a reference to Israel and not to Judah, it is certainly evident in Jeremiah and in the historical books that the practice had spread to Judah after the time of Ahaz. We have already established the fact that the Tyrians are of Israel, And I should say it's evident in the historical books where Josiah broke down the high places and the Tophets, where children were sacrificed in Israel during his reform. I think I have it here. Maybe it's a little later. Yes, it is. I'm sorry. We'll get to it. And Josiah was just before the time of Jeremiah, when he had done that. Evidently, unless Jeremiah lived 60 years, I think he probably prophesied for about 40. I don't think it was 60, though, which Isaiah probably came close to that. We have already established the fact that the Tyrians are of Israel, and this lamentation establishes it as fact even further, because Tyre is still the subject here. And the prophet is describing them as having transgressed the law and forsaking the covenant. The Tyrians must have also been sacrificing their children in the manner of Israel. While this is difficult to prove from Scripture, in ancient history, there were many accusations of the practice in reference to Carthage, a colony of Tyre. So we read from Diodor Siculus in reference to the Roman wars against Carthage, where Baal is associated with the Greek idol Cronus, and the Greeks and Romans were wont to do that when writing about other nations. They would sort of translate the names of the gods of other nations into names that they thought corresponded with their own idols. And for that reason, in literature, even around the time of Christ, the Roman writers thought that the Judeans worshipped Saturn. And that was simply out of confusion with their worship on the seventh day, which they called the Sabbath. So Diodor Siculus wrote, "Therefore the Carthaginians, believing that a misfortune had come to them from the gods, betook themselves to every manner of supplication of the divine powers. And because they believed that Heracles, who was worshipped in their mother's city," Heracles was esteemed to have been descended from the Phoenicians of Tyre, "was exceedingly angry with them, they sent a large sum of money and many of the most expensive offerings to Tyre. Since they had come as colonists from that city, it had been their custom in the earlier period to send the god a tenth of all that was paid into the public revenue. But later, when they had acquired great wealth and were receiving more considerable revenues, they sent very little indeed, holding the divinity of little account. But turning to repentance because of the misfortune, they bethought them, it came into their minds, thoughts, of all the gods of Tyre. They even sent from their temples, in supplication, the golden shrines with their images, believing that they would better appease the wrath of the gods if the offerings were sent for the sake of winning forgiveness. They also alleged that Cronus, meaning Baal, had turned against them inasmuch as in the former times they had been accustomed to sacrifice to this god the noblest of their sons. But more recently, secretly buying and nurturing children, they had sent these to the sacrifice. When an investigation was made, some of those who had been sacrificed were discovered to have been supposititious," and that's a word that means substituted for someone else or something else. "When they had given thought to these things and saw their enemy encamped before the walls," meaning the Romans, "they were filled with superstitious dread, for they believed that they had neglected the honors of the gods that had been established by their fathers. In their zeal to make amends for their omission to sacrifice the noblest children, They selected 200 of the noblest children and sacrificed them publicly. And others who were under suspicion sacrificed themselves voluntarily in a number not less than 300. There was in their city a bronze image of Cronus extending its hands, palms up, and sloping toward the ground. And we've all probably seen that image in the context of ancient Babylon. So that each of the children, when placed thereupon, rolled down and fell into a sort of gaping pit filled with fire. And while this is often disputed by academic historians, there is archaeological evidence which supports this statement by Diodorus. Evidently, the kings of Israel must have been sacrificing their children long before the time of Ahaz, since it is explicitly mentioned in relation to Ahaz in the passage we have cited from 2 Kings. So the Tyrians must have also engaged in the abomination. And perhaps it was from the time of Ahaz that the practice had become popular in Judah, because about 90 years after the death of Ahaz, we read of Josiah in 2 Kings chapter 23, that he defiled Topheth, which is in the valley of the children of Hinnom, that no man might make his son or his daughter to pass through the fire to Moloch. In spite of that, some decades later, in Jeremiah chapter 32, we read that the people had built the high places of Baal, which are in the valley of the son of Hinnom, to cause their sons and their daughters to pass through the fire unto Moloch, which I commanded them not, neither came it into my mind that they should do this abomination to cause Judah to sin. And now, therefore, thus saith Yahweh, the God of Israel, concerning this city whereof you say, it shall be delivered into the hand of the king of Babylon by the sword, and by the famine, and by the pestilence. Back to Isaiah chapter 24 here, where we read, therefore the inhabitants of the earth are burned, and few men left. The Septuagint has verse 6 to read in part, that the dwellers of the earth shall be poor rather than burned, as Breton has it. The Dead Sea Scrolls Bible, as well as the New American Standard Bible, both agree with the King James Version and the literal meaning of the word, charar, which is to burn. And I think it's the source of our English word char and charcoal and related terms. The people burn their sons and daughters, or they fail to protest when their countrymen or even their kings had done as much. So if they themselves suffered being burnt, the punishment is just. Of course, at this point, the people have not yet been burned, but the prophet writes as if they had, because that judgment was sure to come. So the justice in the judgment of Yahweh is fully evident as a proper recompense for such sins. If men burn their children and escape being burned themselves, it is only because God is merciful. The prophet continues his lamentation in verse 7. The new wine mourns, the vine languishes, all the merry-hearted do sigh. The mirth of Tabret cease. The noise of them that rejoice ends. The joy of the harp ceases. They shall not drink wine with a song. Strong drink shall be bitter to them that drink it. This passage evokes the image of the coming fall of Mystery Babylon, as it is prophesied in chapter 18 of the Revelation. All the merchants of the earth shall weep and mourn over her, for no man buys their merchandise anymore. The merchandise of gold and silver and precious stones, and of pearls and fine linen and purple and silk and scarlet, and all thyine wood or citrus wood, and all manner vessels of ivory, and all manner of vessels of most precious wood, and of brass and iron and marble, and cinnamon and odors, and ointments and frankincense, and wine and oil and fine flour, and wheat and beasts and sheep and horses and chariots and slaves and souls of men. Then a little further on in that same chapter, and the voice of harpers and musicians and of pipers and trumpeters shall be heard no more at all in thee. Now, the destruction of Tyre described in the previous chapter is still the context of this passage. And the chapter break is unfortunate, as they often improperly impress a change in context upon the mind of the reader. So the reference to a city here must be a reference to Tyre in verse 10. I'm sorry, my throat hasn't been right since I had that flu back in December. Isaiah chapter 24, verse 10. The city of confusion is broken down. Every house is shut up that no man may come in. While the burden of Babylon was the first burden given by the prophet Isaiah in chapter 13. And the Hebrew word for Babylon is simply Babel, which means confusion. Here, Tyre is called the city of confusion, but it is not the same Hebrew word. The word here is tohu, which is desolation or desert, and sometimes, figuratively, something worthless, according to Strong's Concordance. Verse 11, there is a crying for wine in the streets, all joy is darkened. The mirth of the land is gone. In the city is left desolation, and the gate is smitten with destruction. Perhaps the houses which are shut up here are the houses that survived the Babylonian destruction of the city. In any event, the city eventually fell into, I should say, the mainland city, because this is speaking only of the mainland. In any event, the city eventually fell into virtual abandonment, but was not entirely destroyed, as this verse indicates. What was left, however, seems to have been entirely destroyed in the time of Alexander, king of Macedon. In book 17 of Diodorus's Library of History, we read the following, in reference to Alexander. Then he marched on towards Egypt, and as he came into Phoenicia, received the submission of all the other cities, for their inhabitants accepted him willingly. At Tyre, however, when the king wished to sacrifice to the Tyrian Heracles, the people over hastily barred him from entering the city. Alexander became angry and threatened to resort to force. But the Tyrians cheerfully faced the prospect of a siege. They wanted to gratify Darius, meaning Darius, the king of Persia. The entire region had been under the rule of Persia until the coming of Alexander the Great. They wanted to gratify Darius and keep unimpaired their loyalty to him, and thought also that they would receive great gifts from the king in return for such a favor. They would draw Alexander into a protracted and difficult siege and give Darius time for his military preparations. And at the same time, they had confidence in the strength of their island and the military forces in it. They also hoped for help from their colonists, the Carthaginians. Carthage and Tyre had a relationship in history that's recorded in history up to the end of the 4th century BC, which is where we are approaching now with Alexander. I believe that that relationship is recorded in the histories of Polybius. The king saw that the city, I'm still quoting Diodorus, the king saw that the city could hardly be taken by sea because of the engines mounted along its walls and the fleet that it possessed, while from the land it was almost unassailable because it lay 4 furlongs away from the coast. Nevertheless, he determined to run every risk and make every effort to save the Macedonian army from being held in contempt by a single undistinguished city. Immediately, he demolished what was called Old Tyre and set many tens of thousands of men to work carrying stones to construct a mole or causeway, 2 plethora in width, which is about 200 feet. He drafted into service the entire population of the neighboring cities, and the project advanced rapidly because the workers were numerous. So whatever the Babylonians left of the mainland city was destroyed by Alexander. But the extent to which Alexander destroyed the walls and other structures of the island city is not entirely evident in the account of Diodorus. Although it is said that while many Tyrians managed to escape to Carthage, where we read later in that same book, the Tyrians, however, kept up the resistance with mutual cries of encouragement and blocked the alleys with barricades, so that all except a few were cut down fighting, in number more than 7,000. The king sold the women and children into slavery and crucified all the men of military age. These were not less than 2,000. Although most of the non-combatants had been removed to Carthage, those who remained to become captives were found to be more than 13,000. Here in the burden of Tyre in chapter 23, Isaiah had also warned all of those who removed to Carthage that they would find no rest, where he addressed those who would flee on the ships of Tarshish and said, "Pass over to Kittim, there also shalt thou have no rest." Apparently, very little was left of Tyre until Roman times, when the city was rebuilt, and it's mentioned in the New Testament. Isaiah chapter 24, verse 13. When thus it shall be in the midst of the land among the people, there shall be as the shaking of an olive tree, and as the gleaning grapes when the vintage is done. There are always some olives or grapes left on the vine, even after the harvest is done. There are always some which are missed. Here there is a Hebrew phrase which is poorly represented in Strong's Concordance, mostly on account of his purposely scant treatment of particles, which is ki ka yaya. And I know that sounds awfully strange, the way we transliterate Hebrew into English. Ki ka yaya. And it means, thus it will be. In verse 2, there was a similar use of the same verb to denote a future event. Therefore, it is evident that while the prophet has more frequently used prophetic present or past tenses up to this point, he is indeed describing things which would take place in his own historical future here. In chapter 23, the use of the same verb was found in verses 15 and 17, but that concerned the 70 years during which the destroyed Tyre would be forgotten. Here, the futurity of the vision is more certain. And in the next verse, the use continues. They shall, that same verb, it's plural, the plural form of to be. They shall lift up their voice. They shall sing for the majesty of Yahweh. They shall cry aloud from the sea. This has to be the Tyrians, right? Wherefore glorify ye Yahweh in the fires, even the name of Yahweh, God of Israel, in the isles of the sea. From the uttermost part of the earth we have heard songs, even glory to the righteous. Once again, it becomes fully evident that the inhabitants of ancient Tyre were at least primarily of the children of Israel, even those who were in the islands of the sea. Here there is also an indication of ultimate repentance following the suffering of judgment. But where we read the words here, at the end of the first sentence in verse 16, where it says, even glory to the righteous, when the verse continues, it is apparent that not all of the Tyrians were righteous, or at least many of them were indeed sinners, and Isaiah portrays himself as having made an exclamation in response to the prophetic vision in the second part of verse 16. We cut it off halfway. But I said, my leanness, woe unto me. The treacherous dealers have dealt treacherously. Yeah, the treacherous dealers, maybe Canaanite merchants, who knows? The treacherous dealers have dealt very treacherously. Fear and the pit and the snare are upon thee, O inhabitant of the earth, or of the land. And that also makes me lean towards interpreting these as Canaanites. And it shall come to pass that he who flees from the noise of the fear shall fall into the pit, and he that comes up out of the midst of the pit shall be taken in the snare. For the windows from on high are open, and the foundations of the earth do shake. The wicked and the sinners, and because some of the wicked must be Canaanites, they are two different things. I don't have the references to Canaanites in my notes. I always add things during a podcast. I'm sorry. The wicked and the sinners cannot escape the judgment of Yahweh. If they flee from it in fear, they shall fall regardless and fall even in their own flight. While the opening of windows in heaven is a promise of rain in the time of famine, as it is in the words of Elisha in 2 Kings chapter 7, the idiom is also used to represent the coming of blessings from God, as it is in Malachi chapter 3, where we read, bring ye all the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be meat in mine house, and prove me now herewith, saith Yahweh of hosts, if I will not open you the windows of heaven and pour you out a blessing, that there shall not be room enough to receive it. In other words, you give Yahweh what belongs to him, and he will bless you with bounty. And that's opening the windows of heaven. But here, it doesn't mean anything about blessings or rain. Here it seems to be used to represent the pouring out of the wrath of Yahweh God upon the wicked, which is evident in Ezekiel chapter 21, or in Hosea chapter 5, where we read, the princes of Judah were like them that removed the bound. It was against the law to remove boundaries or change them. That's land stealing. Therefore, I will pour out my wrath upon them like water. In other words, open the windows of heaven to pour out his wrath, is how I would interpret that phrase, open the windows of heaven, or open the windows of on high. Here, or the windows from on high are open, actually. Likewise, where we read, the foundations of the earth do shake. The reference may literally be interpreted to refer to earthquakes, but it seems instead to refer to the fear of men who are the pillars of society. This allegory is fully apparent in the 82nd Psalm, And for context, we shall present the entire psalm, a psalm of Asaph. God stands in the congregation of the mighty. He judges among the gods. How long will ye judge unjustly and accept the persons of the wicked? Defend the poor and fatherless. Do justice to the afflicted and needy. Deliver the poor and needy. Rid them out of the hand of the wicked. They know not, neither will they understand. They walk on in darkness. All the foundations of the earth are out of course. I have said, ye are gods, and all of you are children of the Most High. But you shall die like men and fall like one of the princes. Arise, O God, judge the earth, for thou shalt inherit all nations. The actions or sins of men cannot move the earth, cannot affect the stability of the land, can't have some mysterious, unseen effect, I should say, because, of course, we could simply get a lot of caterpillar tractors and do what we want with the land. The actions or sins of men cannot have some mysterious, unseen effect on the stability of the land. The earth isn't going to have its foundations out of course because a particular man sinned. It's silly to think that. In that psalm, the phrase, the foundations of the earth are out of course, has nothing to do with the land or the physical ground. Rather, it is a description of the men who are the pillars of society. As Paul of Tarsus had used the word pillars to describe the apostles of Christ in Galatians chapter 2. Going back to the psalm, these men, the foundations of society, were out of course because they were not defending the poor, the fatherless, the needy, nor were they protecting them from the wicked. So they walked in darkness and wandered out of course. But the psalm encourages them to repentance because they are the children of God. So likewise, the word earth here is really just a reference to the society. As we proceed. And a friend in the chat just sent me a note. Romans 1:18, for the wrath of Yahweh is revealed from heaven upon all unjust. And it's similar to what I was saying. It's not a direct correlation to the language, the vision of wrath being poured out from heaven, even though that's certainly what Paul was suggesting. Okay. Verse 19, and the way the word earth is used here is really just a reference to the society. It's not the planet. The earth is utterly broken down. The earth is clean dissolved. The earth is moved exceedingly. The earth shall reel to and fro like a drunkard, and shall be removed like a cottage. And the transgression thereof shall be heavy upon it, and it shall fall and not rise again. The actual land of Israel has never dissolved, nor has the land or the planet ever reeled to and fro like a drunkard. Neither was it removed like a cottage. Neither could the land actually fall. And if you believe the earth's a pancake, what is the land going to fall on? If the earth is the bottom, you stupid asses. I'm sorry, I'm just really frustrated with the idiocy of the flat earth people that believe all these things. And that's a digression and a distraction. The land cannot actually fall. And neither could it be blamed for transgression. I should say the earth could not actually fall, the way they use the term earth. And neither could it be blamed for transgression. as the law was for the people of Israel to keep, and not the land of Israel. The people had to keep the law, not the land. So once again, the references to the earth are to the society, to the people and their political, economic, and social organization on the land. Collectively, they alone were guilty of transgression, wandering in their transgressions, which were both serious and numerous. They reeled to and fro as a collectively drunk society. But there is a strong sense of far vision meaning throughout this lamentation. And perhaps in all of this, Tyre stands for the commerce of Israel throughout the world, as do the ships of Tarshish. And the merchandise of Tyre stands for the intercourse and trade which Israel has had with the pagan and non-Adamic nations throughout the history of their captivity. Such world trade has always led to fornication, not only spiritually, but in race mixing with alien peoples, which is evident throughout history. And for that reason also, the system of world trade is called Mystery Babylon in the Revelation, after the name of ancient Babel, since it is confusion, and Babel means confusion, by mixing. In the end, all of those who maintain that system, the wealthy merchants of the earth, are punished, and in ancient Israel, they were associated with Tyre, a city of merchants. So we read in verse 21. And it shall come to pass in that day that Yahweh shall punish the host of the high ones that are on high, and the kings of the earth upon the earth. And they shall be gathered together as prisoners are gathered in the pit, and shall be shut up in the prison. And after many days shall they be visited. So they're not all Canaanites. Tyre had also been called the crowning city, or as we had explained when we discussed Isaiah chapter 23, verse 8, the bestower of crowns. The reason for this appellation is evident in the Revelation in chapter 13, where we read, "And they worshiped the dragon which gave power unto the beast. And they worshiped the beast, saying, Who is like unto the beast? Who is able to make war with him?" Before the coming of Alexander, the island fortress of ancient Tyre was also reckoned to have been invincible. So Tyre is certainly an example for men today, that mystery Babylon shall also fall. The final verse of this chapter is not the end of this vision, which continues into chapter 25 and beyond. "Then the moon shall be confounded, and the sun ashamed, when Yahweh of hosts shall reign in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem, and before his ancients gloriously." Of course, the physical moon and the physical sun aren't going to be confused and ashamed when Yahweh of hosts sits as king on earth, reigns in Mount Zion. But they're not to be understood literally either. As we have discussed, where similar statements appear in the Revelation, and particularly in Revelation chapter 6, the sun and the moon represent government and its bureaucracy. Ancient kings esteemed themselves to be the light bearers of their respective societies, and their officers reflected that light by upholding the laws of the king. This we had also discussed in a different context here in Isaiah, in our commentary on Lucifer, son of the morning, from Isaiah chapter 14. So the sun represents the earthly kings of Israel. The sun here represents the earthly kings of Israel. In Revelation chapter 6, it represented the emperors of Rome. And the moon represents the officers in their governments, in their offices, in the governments of those kings, because they're reflecting the laws of the king. This vision actually continues beyond chapter 25, and there is no apparent break in the context, as far as I've seen, I may have missed one, until the opening of chapter 36, and the next major event in the history of Israel, which is the invasion of Sennacherib, or Sennacherib. So there are statements related to this vision throughout the subsequent chapters, and especially in chapters 27 and 28. First, in chapter 27, we read in part, "In that day, Yahweh, with his sore and great and strong sword, shall punish Leviathan, the piercing serpent." The piercing serpent. Even Leviathan, that crooked serpent. "And he shall slay the dragon that is in the sea." The dragon, which gives its power to the beast. The phrase "in that day" refers to the same day of wrath, which Yahweh had mentioned here in verse 21. But the dragon in the sea is not a sea creature in a literal sea. Rather, as we discussed at length in relation to the burden of the desert of the sea, the sea is the mass of the world's peoples, and the dragon are the children of the serpent, the descendants of the Nephilim and all of those who have mixed with the fallen angels, including the children of Cain. These are the power who have perpetually, These are the dragon who have perpetually given their power to the beast so that they can supplant Israel and rule the earth. Then in Isaiah chapter 28, we read, "Woe to the crown of pride, to the drunkards of Ephraim, whose glorious beauty is a fading flower, which are on the head of the fat valleys of them that are overcome with wine. And while Tyre was a city of Asher and Zebulun, as it is in the most ancient copies of Scripture." In the original languages, the name of Ephraim, in the older prophets, I must have been really tired when I typed this. Some of the other prophets, the name of Ephraim, and this is especially true in Hosea, but it's true elsewhere as well. The name of Ephraim was used to describe all of the 10 tribes, as Ephraim was the chief of the tribes and the government belonged to him, the government in Samaria. So collectively speaking, these drunkards of Ephraim are the pillars or foundations of the Israelite society who reel to and fro like drunkards because they are in a state of sin. And this concludes our commentary on Isaiah chapter 24. Thank you for listening. Praise Yahweh, the God of Israel, and good night.